moving on, as they say, my first guest this morning knows what it means, actually, funnily enough, after that headline, knows what it means to live under a constant death threat. Becoming a politician in the 70s, he lived through some of the darkest days of the Northern Troubles. A target of paramilitaries, his home was kind of like a fortress, bulletproof windows, security features. At one point, he even saw a mural depicting himself hanging from a gallows and another poster accusing him of being an informer. Yet against that backdrop of the King's Mill atrocity, the Miami Show Band massacre and the daily killings that marked that terrible period in the North, Seamus Mallon made it his business to condemn all those who chose violence. Now, four decades long, his legacy is cemented as one of the architects of the Good Friday Agreement. Seamus Mallon, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You're welcome to the programme again.
Thank you.
This book of yours stretches across quite a wide range, but I guess the stories about the sectarianism just leap out at you. The word sectarian is kind of just an ordinary word, but the reality of it. You made a decision at one point that you would attend funerals of anybody who was murdered, be they Protestant or Catholic.
That's correct. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to fulfil in total that. But I felt that as a representative of the nationalist community, that I had to show to the authorities and to the unionist community that, in effect, I spoke for my community when I went to those funerals and when I condemned the acts of violence. I thought it was absolutely necessary to do that because at that period of time, people, I don't think, realise how close we were to a civil war in certain parts of the north of Ireland, one of them being County Armagh. It was tipping that way for a considerable length of time.
Tell me about going to the funeral of an IRA man. Now, everybody knew your view on the IRA, because you constantly condemned their activities. But you went to this funeral.
Yes, I went because I thought it was, and it was, a shoot-to-kill incident by the army. They had been covering him for a number of hours in Collyhanna. They could have arrested him at any time during that period. I went to the funeral to show my condemnation of what the army had done. Unfortunately, I was in the graveyard after it, and the old traditional Republican speeches at the graveyard. And it happened to be a man called James McAllister who was making the oration, and he launched into an attack on me, accused me of all kinds of things, said I was a Brit lover, and that I was a UDR lover, all of the pieces of venom that he could pull up. I was standing there on my own at the side of the grave. My inclination was to walk away. I didn't. I said, no, I'm staying. James, and I knew James. James isn't going to put me out of this or any other graveyard. So it was...
So you were surrounded by IRA people?
Some, yes. Mostly.
Yeah.
But there were many other people there who were neighbours who weren't IRA people.
Yeah.
And many of them came to me later and said how disgusted they were to hear it. But that was it. Yeah, it was that type of life.
Yeah, then you describe going to another funeral and hearing the sound of your own feet walking down the street.
Yes, that was in Bessbrook. It was the first funerals of the men who were killed coming from work at King's Mills. It was the only time, I think, in my life that I ever heard the sound of my feet walking through a village. It was eerie. And it was...
Remind people what had happened.
The men were coming from work in the minibus. There was a bogus road check. They thought it was a loyalist group coming to kill a Catholic. The question was put, who's the Catholic here? And at that, one of the men took the Catholic by the hand. They were spread-eagled against the minibus and just held his hand as much as say, don't, you'll be all right, we'll protect you. And he was singled out and told to run. And immediately the fires, the shots came. And they were all killed. The man who had held his hand, Reggie Chapman, among others, eight others, I suppose.
So there was complete outrage at that. There really was. And you went to those, to one, you couldn't presumably have gone to them all, you went to the funeral.
Yes, yes. And I still have that mental image of Reggie's hand taking the hand of the man who was, he was trying to save just before he himself was murdered, along with others. And to add to that, coming down the same road was the cortege of the young Reeves, who had been killed the night before.
And remind on people of that?
Again, there was police and UDR involvement. The three guys were sitting at their own home, chatting around the fireside. Gunmen came in, killed two immediately. The third lad died. He died in hospital a week later. But their cortege was coming home on the same road as the people were lying there dead who had been killed at King's Mills, and they had to be diverted. So there you had a case of the dead almost meeting the dead, of two sets of victims on the same road, in the same place that we all live, and it was an appalling vista. That was replicated, maybe not as bad, but very bad, elsewhere, where people were just assassinated.
Right.
And the gang, the Glen Ann gang, as it became known as, who carried out most of these, 111 is the latest figure of people killed by a grouping which included policemen and UDR men. Now, that's as near to civil war as one can get.
When you went to Bessbrook, how did the other mourners deal with you?
Oh, very, very helpfully. People came up, said, good to see you here. Took me in hand almost, the churchman who was delivering the service, he welcomed me. And people went out of their way to show that they were pleased that I came.
Yeah. And yet, you describe as well hostility, kind of venomous hostility, just because one is a Catholic or just because one is a Protestant. You kind of got into politics, as it were, as a lot of politicians say, accidentally, and it was to do with a man whose children you were teaching.
Yes, I knew him well. I'd been to school with him, and I was teaching his children. He lived in a very, very unsatisfactory house. It was a hovel, no running water, no inside toilet. He went to the council, and in those days, the councillor had the allocation of houses. He asked, put his case, and the councillor said, no Catholic pig or his litter will have a house in Market Hill as long as I'm here.
I read that line about five times. Mm. It's an extraordinary thing to say.
It was. Extraordinary in the sense that somebody like that had the allocation of public houses on which public money was spent. But the, I suppose the good side of that, I decided I had to do something. I didn't know what to do. I went to Jim Nelson, who was the local doctor, who wasn't a nationalist or Catholic. I said, look, Jim, this is the situation. He said, right, I'll go with you on this. I don't want that. I went to another man who had a pub, Tommy Robinson, whose son was the head of the Northern Ireland Civil Service quite recently. I said to Tommy, this is what's happening in the village we live in. And a brave man, he stood out and says, yes, I'll go with you. So we went to see the MP, who at that time was Sir Norman Strong, who was later murdered in his house by the IRA. And he looked out the window as if disinterestedly. But we got houses built, and people were... that stemmed from that incident. But it was rampant right throughout the whole of the north of Ireland. Those were just in the little, and the little part of County Armagh where I lived.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting because you go back to a certain extent in history, and it all goes back to the plantations.
Oh, probably before it, because the key element there is that the two sets of people, those who were maybe mostly Scottish, who were came with the people who were planted as retainers, and those who were known then in British and English terms as the Gaelic Papists. And part of the role of those who were settled at the pre-plantation and plantation time was to Protestantise these native Gaelic-speaking people.
Yeah, like the French did in Vietnam.
From then, the two sets of people were set in enmity against each other. A binary situation where, in effect, ones were the overlords and others were those who were going to rise up against them.
Can I move you on? Why did you join the SDLP?
I was very impressed by their presentation. The use of television at that time was very important in this. It was at the stage where televisions were almost then in every home, but they're still new. And we were seeing the Martin Luther King's, the Rosa Park, the song We Shall Overcome. We saw what was happening in Paris. And we started to ask the questions, what kind of a place have we got here? And then the first civil rights march in Duke Street in Derry. Luckily, there was an RTE cameraman there, and the police were seen hammering people who were simply marching down a street. There were only 200 of them, and it became a focal point. That was at a time when you had John Hume, Ivan Cooper, Austin Curry, Jerry Fitt, those guys starting the civil rights campaign. And I became involved in that. I became involved prior to that because I had tried to tune in with Dr. McCluskey and his wife in relation to the research on fair employment and injustice in relation to jobs and housing. But the impact of seeing people that you knew on television, especially the mature way in which dealt with those problems attracted me to the party that they then formed. It became a very powerful organisation at that time. And the role for us may not have been our choosing, was to steer away into justice, into a set of relationships between Unionist, Nationalist, Catholic and Protestant. And it became clear fairly early that you can only walk up and down the streets a few times. You had to get in where the fight really was, into the political arena. And that is what many of us did. And
how did your wife Gertrude take to it when you said you were going to run for politics?
She didn't like one bit of it. And I can understand why. It was very insecure, let's put it that way, and that's putting it mildly. And it was very dangerous. And she was a nurse, and she, for a number of years, she kept me because I had no income. And my daughter and Gertrude were in a very dangerous situation. We knew all that very quickly, but she stood by me and worked and took the risks. And
did you worry about them when you were, you know, because in your life, a very busy life and meetings and travel and all that, they were in the house on their own, but you wouldn't take protection?
I wouldn't and didn't, for this reason, that I knew where I lived, that whoever was going to be protecting me, it would have been a policeman or policeman. They'd have been killed. There's no question or doubt about that. And if one side didn't kill them, the other would. And I said to the authorities, the police authority, look, I don't mean any offence, but I don't want that on my conscience. I have enough to live with. But it was a horrendous time. And the only way in which we got through it was on a day-to-day basis, and had the type of relationship that allowed me to do the things you have to do in politics, and to ensure that whatever I could do to get protection for them, I did.
Right. OK. I'm going to move you on, because we seem to be going somewhat backwards today in politics. I mean, you took great pride in the Sunningdale Agreement, and then we came around to the Anglo-Irish Agreement, and then we got the Good Friday Agreement, all based on similar kind of ideas. How do you read it today? You didn't approve of the Hume Adams talks. Let me come to that first.
Oh, I did. There were parts of it I didn't approve of. And I was very concerned, and still recognise it, and still is the view I hold, that there was a point at during those talks. I fully supported John in getting peace. Who wouldn't? And it was at a point when, in effect, the government policy changed from Sunningdale right through the Anglo-Irish Agreement Joint Declaration. Up until that, it had been the policy of the British and Irish governments was to build from the centre, a strong centre, out. It changed. It then became, it was going to be built on the extremes. At that point, I saw what was happening. And I made it clear to John, and I made it clear to our party, that we were going to suffer, and that we shouldn't allow that to happen, because what was required was, at a certain point, for the two governments backed by the United States and by public opinion in Ireland said to them, you cannot be part of a government while you hold illegal arms to fight against the role of the Irish government on this island. It wasn't done. I think the fear, and probably a legitimate fear, was that the IRA would have backed off. I believe they should have been, their bluff should have been called, because I know from good source that they were on their uppers at that point.
And it's a high risk thing to do. I remember just looking, somebody took it out for me this morning, Fergus Finlay saying it around that time, that having these talks without the IRA, or Sinn Féin, the talks wouldn't have been worth a penny candle. And he got lacerated for that. And he was accused of being kind of a fellow traveller with the provost and all the language that was thrown around at that time. But without them there, we wouldn't have got the Good Friday Agreement.
Yes, but the way in which the structures operated. Number one, and let's remember, it took 11 years for decommissioning to take place. Twice as long as the First World War. So there was no rush on that part of the IRA to get rid of the arms. It was allowed, that issue of decommissioning was allowed to be as a cloud over the entire political process, right? Let's face it, if you were a unionist, as David Trimble and others were, and all of a sudden one of the senior members of the IRA Army Council becomes Deputy First Minister of the administration that you're in, you'd find it slightly difficult. You'd find it very unnatural. And even more unnatural because their involvement in government was quite some time before decommissioning was done. Now, why were they doing that? They were doing that to actually split the Ulster Unionist Party, which they did. They were doing that to ensure that we took as many hits as we possibly could, and we took them. So the middle...
You mean politically?
Politically. So the middle ground, those who had created peace, those who had held on to peace, were sacrificed, as it were, to bring in those who had been involved in violence and the threat of violence.
But you know, 2 days before the agreement was signed, there were murders. The whole thinking, well, maybe it wasn't the same north of the border, but the whole thinking, I think, down here was to get peace and to get people to live without shootings and killings day after day after day.
Yeah. 2 days before Points Pass, a place I know well, I played for their football team many years ago. And I knew Bernadette Canavan, who owned the pub, and the two lads came in after work. And a loyalist paramilitant walked in with a gun and shot both of them. David Trimble and I went down the next morning, and we went from house to house. And I do believe that had an effect on both of us, an effect which allowed us to actually finalise the Good Friday Agreement. It was the awfulness of two lads, one a Catholic, one a Protestant, had been out working. One had asked the other to be his best man at his wedding, and this loyalist gunman kills him. Now, we had to end that. But the difficulty, I was all in favour, and I did everything I possibly could to support John in terms of police. But I knew that it was going to... The way in which the Sinn Féin were managing it, that it was going to split the middle. And it has... It did split the middle unionism and middle nationalism. And we have been paying up for it ever since.
You mentioned that you supported John. Do you have a reputation for having had a tetchy relationship between the two of you? And there was an interesting quote in the book about balls of roasted snow.
Oh, yeah. John at times had... could be florid in his in his language, use of language. I had no problem with that. We did have discussions. We had many a disagreement. We had very few rows because we were able to cope with it.
Tell me about that occasion.
Just the point I have been making there to you, I was making to him, saying, look, I believe that we're going to suffer for this, that the middle will go and that the extremes will come in and they will, in many ways, destroy the political process. And John had... We had words about it, and he said, I don't give two balls of roasted snow. What do you think? No, that's to me is a colourful means of saying, Seamus, I don't agree with you. And I took it as that.
Do you think he should have given up the leadership earlier?
Well, he didn't. Had he done so, I think it could have been important. His health wasn't good. And, you know, coming through that period of time, all of the ongoing negotiations, whole question of policing, the whole question of revamping a justice system. And I felt sorry for him because he was not well. And had he gone, we'd have been able to tighten up some of the elements in our party. Organisation, which we didn't, we couldn't do it at that time. But
was he running it as a one-man show, basically?
No, it was. He liked to get his own way. Who doesn't?
Mm-hmm.
We shared the responsibilities. I was spokesperson for justice. That meant policing, UDR, courts, judges who praised paramilitaries, all of that on the ground. It was difficult because every time I walked down the street where I live, I was meeting someone whose husband, a policeman, was shot dead. And the night before I'd been on television saying that the police had to be reformed. That wasn't easy. So John worked at a level and I worked at a level, and we did it in a way that I believe was very positive.
How did you work? You were the first Deputy First Minister. How did you work with Trimble?
I like David Trimble, you know. It's very difficult to like David Trimble. But I had known him, you see. We were in the Northern Ireland Assembly in 1973 together. And then we were in a House of Commons together. He had a very florid visage. He could go off the handle very quickly. And my approach to him was, sit down there. You're not leaving this meeting. Now sit here. And we got used to each other working like that. And
you said he made an art form of walking out of meetings.
Oh, yes. Mo Molam had had a remarkably good skit on it. She came out of a meeting one evening and shouting as only Mo could, "I had a meeting and David didn't walk out the door. It was very successful." So, it was. He just had that quick temper. Let's not forget that during that period of time, his party was folding up. They were leaving him. His senior people left to go into the DUP, and yet he was man enough to fight it out. And he was man enough to go through with the Good Friday Agreement in the face of that type of opposition. I remember standing outside the polling station in Banbridge, his last election, and watched himself and Daphne coming out, been spat upon, been hit, been abused, been kicked by so-called loyalists. Now, I could forgive him for many things when I saw the way in which he was treated by his...
By his own people?
By his own people. And, you see, he was the second that I had seen. I'd seen Brian Faulkner treated in exactly the same way. And here you had a crisis within the unionist population. And that is where I think we should be focusing now, the political process, focusing. Because the whole role of the political process now is to deal with what is going to happen. We all know that the campaign for a border poll, 50% plus one, is gathering momentum. We all know that there are people in the north of Ireland who are using it, and using it sometimes very cleverly and sometimes not so cleverly. I believe, and I believe very firmly, that a border poll at this time would be very dangerous indeed. It would be very difficult. And I put it to the test in this way. Is the north of Ireland ready for unification? Is the south of Ireland ready for a border poll towards unification? Is Ireland as a whole ready for a united Ireland? And for a border poll which would be carried 50% plus one? Now that plus one could be the representation of unionism in that type of poll. That's not what the Good Friday Agreement was about. It said unity could only come by consent and agreement. You're not going to get agreement if you're beating people around the head with the 50% plus one policy, which would essentially almost exclude them.
And as it were, reverse the situation, that you would have a different, resentful minority. So how would you go about mending those things? Since I know in certain circumstances you would like a united Ireland.
That's why I'm so obsessed almost with this, because I want it. I believe that there shouldn't be a border poll and until we have made, taken steps to ensure that it is not going to be a crisis point, that it is not going to be accompanied by violence. We have got to deal with unionism in a way that they didn't deal with us. In other words, the shoe will be on the other foot. And I am already hearing people within the nationalist community, we'll just sit them out. You know, and that's a clever tactic, because anything can happen during that. I don't believe we can. I think the executive has to get going again, the assembly has to get going, and we have to start looking at arrangements short of a 32-county Ireland. Arrangements that the unionists might be able to take confidence in and agree. I myself would be look favourably on a form of confederalism. It was identified in the forum report in a very very clear way. Sir George Quigley, who was a remarkable figure in his own way and wasn't anticipating discussion about Irish unity before a lot of people. I believe that a confederal arrangement could bridge that gap.
You also make a point about percentages. The 50% plus one on either side doesn't work, really. Well, that's your contention. And you say if 40% of both sides were in support of something, that would give it would mend those kinds of difficulties that existed in reverse before.
Yes, and it would allow unionist people to recognise that agreement worked and consent. Their consent was part of the process, and that we could get to then a type of generosity into the political process where we could start and work for the future.
Do you see any generosity at the moment?
I do. I see it among people who have lived through hard times. I don't see it in the political process. But we, and people involved in the political process, have got to steer ourselves and the community into a mindset where the role of politics isn't to give the other parties a black eye, that the role of politics is going to be how we get Catholic, Protestant, dissenter, people with different religions or none, people who have come in to the north of Ireland recently from other countries.
You know, you talked about the middle and the centre, but what we have at the moment is Sinn Féin and the DUP, and the DUP is in a fortuitous position from their interests, as they would see it, because of their influence in the current government, however long that lasts. But sometimes politics becomes incomprehensible. Now, I'm aware that Arlene Foster had a very, very difficult dealings with IRA and shootings and all of that, and you can imagine that leaves a mark. But her remark about the crocodiles, like, just, not to sound old-fashioned too much, in terms of courtesy or manners, it's quite an extraordinary thing to have said.
Oh, very much so. And it is indicative. It is indicative of this layer of hatred that is there between the two sets of people, unionist, nationalist, Catholic, Protestant. And it is within that gap that we have. Politics has got to work. And it has to close that gap.
How?
Working together.
But look at it. I mean, I hear Mary Lou MacDonald saying, you know, that she's going to go into these talks with an open mind, generosity of spirit and all that. But there is a tone that says, if we don't get, which in fairness was agreed in St. Andrews, we're not going to go any further. It just seems like stalemate.
Yeah, well, Mary Lou McDonald may not be giving the position of the IRA and Sinn Féin. We should work that. She's been told what to say, and Sir Emery
denies that. Oh, well. She has denied it repeatedly and repeatedly. Yeah.
Yes, well, I'd like to take her word for it. The reality is this. The rise of Sinn Féin and the rise of the DUP is what a good friend of mine, since dead, John Fee, you probably have met him, used to call the sparable boot syndrome. When the others get up, we put our hard men in to take them down. And that is the type of politics, unfortunately, that we've had for so long. You have a situation, Marion, where I live, where the Ulster Unionist Party was the top party in Northern Ireland by a mile. At the moment, they don't even bother, many of them, to vote. They are not going to vote for the DUP, and they're not going to vote in a political
process. So why don't they vote for the UUP?
Pardon?
Why don't they vote for the UUP?
Because they're not getting the vote.
Right.
And I have had discussion after discussion with them, and it is getting to a stage where the middle ground now has got to coalesce to get a working arrangement to take on the extremes and get that type of generosity into politics, which alone can get us down the road towards a solution, a lasting solution. That lasting solution, in my view, is Irish unity. But it may not be obtainable for a time in terms of the Sinn Féin definition of unity, the type of confederation which could move in that direction, could change the face.
Well, if you look at the times and dates from Sunningdale, Anglo-Irish, and on to the Good Friday Agreement, these things take a long time from 1973 to 1998 to get that far. It would be a heartbreak to go backwards. Can I read you some of the calls coming in? The peace process destroyed the centre ground. Well, that's your point, in Northern Ireland, including the SDLP, and made the Republican movement more powerful than ever. Please ask Seamus Mallon, has this been a price worth paying?
Yeah, peace.
Okay.
He said peace is paramount.
Lovely to hear Seamus Mallon and his amazing first-hand accounts. That's from Sligo. Hi, Marion. It's not before time that Northern Ireland's most fearless and honourable politician has produced a book. I cannot wait to buy it. Well, it's a compelling read. Another says, Seamus Mallon is a hero of politics. This is one of the most important interviews on RT in a long time. A genuine hero who changed his ravaged home place for the better. Very rare. Thank goodness he's finally written a book. Somebody else saying, wonderful to hear Seamus Mallon. I've always admired him. In many ways, the unsung hero of the North. I loved the excerpt, said another, describing Mo Molum's remark to your awakening words. Let me just have another look at that. I loved the excerpt describing Mo Molum's remark to your awakening words. The remarkable bravery, leadership and resolve shown by yourself is most inspirational. Good to hear the recognition of the cost to your family in supporting your role with high risks attached. We are all indebted to people and families of this calibre. You were very fond of Mo Molum.
Very fond of her. I knew her when she came in new into the House of Commons. She was like a breath of fresh air and very good on the floor, very good on television. But she had a remarkably kind centre to her. She did things in the north of Ireland that no other Secretary of State could have done or would have even attempted to do. She brought the coldness of New Labour into a different ballgame. And I always remember when David Trimble and I were invited to speak at the Labour Party conference. And before us, we were sitting on the platform with Tony Blair. When Mo spoke, she got three standing ovations.
Maybe that was her mistake.
I turned to David Trimble and I said, she'll be gone soon. And, you know, she wasn't treated well by the Labour Party or by Tony Blair. She died and her husband died very soon after all of that. But she had a warmth and a kindness. She described herself during the talks as Her Majesty's Tea Lady because she was not involved in much of the discussions, which was a terrible way to treat a Secretary of State. But when you see the like of Mo and you see the way in which she was treated, you begin to ask yourself, you know, what are the processes within politics which can protect the well-being of people in politics at the same time as we're trying to protect the well-being of people that we represent. Mo was a gift, in my view, which was paramount for the Labour Party and essential, absolutely essential for Northern Ireland at that time.
Well, the man that followed her as in that role wanted to change some element of the Patten Report. And you took the law, well, not the law, into your, you took custom into your own hands and headed for Tony Blair's residence?
Yeah. Mandelson was the name of that gentleman.
Peter Mandelson,
no,
yeah.
Forgive me, he wasn't a gentleman.
I hold on the bell. You didn't like him.
I disliked him intensely because he couldn't be trusted. I said through...
You know, in negotiations, there's ebb and flow. You didn't like him. That's fine. But tell me what he was going to do with the policing.
That's what I was trying to get to.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had sat through 3 months, almost 4 months, of committee stage of that bill with over 80 amendments tabled. On the key of those amendments, Adam Ingram, who was the minister who was handling the bill for the government, said, look, we cannot deal with that now. It will be dealt with at the report stage. That is when the bill goes back into Parliament. There were at least 6 to 8 of the key amendments were postponed until we got to the report stage. I went into the House of Commons that morning, ready, well read up for these key amendments, and Mandelson got up and proposed guillotine because of the pressure of business. In other words, our key elements dropped. That was it. Now, I knew he had a meeting with the Ulster Unionists that morning, along with Blair. So I told him what I thought of him on the floor of the House of Commons. And at that weekend, I went over to London and got myself out to Chequers, a beautiful place. And I knocked the door and Tony came to meet me and he invited me in. I said, I just want to tell you 2 things. Number one, Mandelson has destroyed any prospects of getting a change to policing. He didn't make up in terms of the patent report, and he did the dirt on us. That's the first thing I want to tell you. The second thing I want to tell you is this. There'll be no political agreement, because we couldn't have an agreement that didn't deal with justice and policing. Now, I'm telling you now, Tony, that's the position. And you get back to Mandelson and let him know that. So off he went. Then, sometime months, maybe a year later, there was this remarkable conference at Weston Park. And I knew from his, the way he was talking, that he was going to go back on the policing bill. So it had to be all done again because of Mandelson. Now, he was a dirty tricks merchant, and he tried every
trick. According to you.
Pardon?
According to you.
Oh, yes, and I can, if I had the time, I could give you a clear indication of some of them. That, however, and 2 years later, and X number of million pounds later, a new bill was brought. It was finalised. We got the policing issue dealt with, and bye-bye, Mandelson. He went to the House of Lords and hasn't been heard of since.
Right, well, I get a clear picture of your picture of Mr. Mandelson. Another caller. We'll wind up now fairly shortly. Seamus Mallon was probably the most astute politician in the north of Ireland for the last 50 years. The phrase Sunningdale for slow learners summed up the Good Friday Agreement succinctly. Another one. Hi, Marion. Great to hear Seamus Mallon and hearing the depth and honesty of his story, life and part in bringing peace to these shores. His contribution is often an unsung hero when others got the credit for the way he reached out. He was so right that the middle ground would go. History shows that, thank you, we owe you a debt of gratitude, and that comes to Hugh. And I wanted to talk to you about loads more, but I can't because I won't have the time to do so. But congratulations on this. And really, I suppose, as well as being a memoir, you're trying to get that message across that 50% plus one doesn't work.
Exactly. And if I can convince people of that, I think we could start then to do the real work of the political process. And that is to get the community in the north of Ireland to be a community, not two different tribes.
Okay. Seamus Mallon, thank you very, very much indeed. The book is called A Shared Home Place by Seamus Mallon. And I see Andy Pollock is there as well. Listen, lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. And we'll take a break.